Good morning and welcome to Playback.
Nice curl! Oh, I say, what an unbelievable goal! The 16-year-old Lamine Yamal. That is absolutely astonishing. He becomes the youngest player ever to score in a European Championship.
There was lots of talk about soccer on the airwaves this week. That goal that put Spain into the final of the Euros. The former dentist who's been named as the new Republic of Ireland manager. And why most Irish people still can't bring themselves to cheer for England. But first, talking to Claire Byrne on Wednesday, Spanish football journalist Guillaume Balague described the conversation he had with 16-year-old Lamine Yamal the previous night, shortly after he scored that incredible goal.
Speaking to him after the game was like, Yeah, I just saw, you know, it could be a good opportunity to shoot. I did so. 16-year-old who's got milk in his veins, but certainly a lot of talent in his feet.
Guillaume also gave Claire his ever so slightly biased view on the merits of Spain qualifying for the final of the Euros.
This sounds a little bit pretentious, but for football, because if these kind of tournaments, even though they are a knockout tournament, even though it's only seven games, and even though it depends on so many things who wins it, the winner tends to create a fashion, a trend. And if the trend is the way we play with yes, aggression, but with creativity, wanting the ball, adapting to whatever happens, with togetherness, with bravery, if that's the fashion, great. We'd all enjoy that. We all want our teams to play that way. So, yesterday, I think I called it, it was Batman versus the Joker. The bad guys were France, for sure, the way they play with the talent they've got. And Batman won because the good guys tend to win at the end.
Yeah, and Batman's been waiting for a while because Spain hasn't even won anything since 2010, of course, before then. But there's been a long drought. So there's going to be huge excitement now in Spain over this.
I remember a time when it wasn't just, 12 years ago that we didn't win anything. It used to be 60 years that we didn't win anything. So for me, 12 years is nothing. In fact, if we never win anything again, we won already a lot. But now I think if we win, which will be the fourth European Championships, you have to say that in the 21st century, we have been the best nation in the world, because we've won World Cups and European Championships, and because we set trends. We did do that in 2008-2012 era, and I think we could do the same if we win.
Well, who doesn't want to see Batman win, Guillaume? I mean, that's the bottom line, isn't it, for all of the neutrals.
Later in the day, as the focus began to shift onto the England versus Netherlands game, Mary Minahan, features editor of the Irish Times and Derry Woman, told Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time about the divide that had emerged in her household over which team to cheer for.
I think I'll be supporting the Orange men tonight. I'll be going for the Netherlands, but my children children will be going for England. This was something they announced fairly recently, actually. It was when Scotland got knocked out, and I was saying how sad I was that our neighbours were out of the Euros. They very logically and simply said, England are our neighbours too, and they're still in, so we're going to go for them. It was interesting to hear them say that. I guess, you know, they're young, they're 8 and 10. They don't have any of the baggage that we carry. And I'm always saying, you know, we learn more from our children than they'll ever learn from us. So I guess when I was a youngster, no one would have ever had to say to me that supporting England in a football match was not the done thing.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not going to say that to them. But it's been a really interesting time kind of examining my feelings around this.
Yeah. So have you said anything to them, or have you explained to them why some people in Ireland might not support England, or have you got into that conversation at all with them?
Do you know what? I haven't, because they've been too busy outside reenacting the panels for me to get into explaining all that. And, you know, I don't think I would, because, you know, I don't want to kind of impose my prejudices or my feelings on them. I guess they're simply too young to have learned about what we might euphemistically refer to as Ireland's troubled history with England. And, you know, I do feel conflicted about this myself.
Could I convince you here? I'm shouting for England because I think Gareth Southgate... Yeah, I'll tell you why, right? Gareth Southgate is an understated manager, not like older England managers. It's not a showy lot. They're decent guys. And also their striker is a Conor Arman, Harry Kane. Join
me,
Mary.
I mean, my kids are able to tell me this. You know, they can give me chapter and verse about the number of English players that would qualify to play for Ireland under the grandparent rule. But according to the kids, anyway, they choose not to do so because, you know, the Ireland team isn't good enough. And I guess that's the thing that we have to bear in mind. It's, you know, we all remember Italia 90. We all remember Jack Charlton. But sad to say, for my children and your children, the boys in green haven't brought any great moments of pride into their lifetime as yet. Anyhow, like, I believe in going forward in a spirit of optimism. I believe things can only get better for Ireland, and our team will compete in future Euros, and my boys will get behind them for sure.
But in the meantime, they're shouting for England. Will there be any English jerseys in the house if they get into the finals?
Yes, I had begun to think, you know, this is a new generation. I'm
a step too far even for Cormac. Sorry, Mary.
But, you know, these guys are progressive, they're mature, and maybe they've got the right idea after all. But, you know, when I heard the request for an English jersey, I thought, I can't be that cool about it. I think maybe that is just that step too far.
And now I'm conflicted, because when you talk about spending money on an English jersey, that is something different there, all right.
Comedian Dara O'Brien, who, as it happens, lives in London, also has conflicted feelings about cheering for England, which he admitted to Ray on Monday.
Were you shouting for England when you went over to Dusseldorf?
I would say I wasn't shouting against them. But because
your
I was
poor
there with
grandmother,
the, with the boy.
Your poor grandmother.
But I've also.
Was it your great grandmother or your grandmother?
It was my grandmother.
Yes.
For Ireland. But then there's her great grandson, the son of mine, sitting beside me. Sure, I can't turn to a child and go, in your face, take that. That's one for Switzerland. That's for Ockham. That's for 1798. I can't stand and roar at the child. Sure, that'd be perverse.
Well, they have to have a connection with their roots, Dara. You know,
they do, but they also have. They also live in the now. But I sense
there's a bit of conflict there for you.
No, it's an interesting journey. Let's put it that way.
Right.
No, I got to be over here roaring against them a while ago now, because it became a bit perverse to be in company of friends and going, And although when they lost to Iceland, I was amidst a load of English lads, this is in 2016, and I were sitting watching the house. I had to go behind the couch and stand behind them because I was just enjoying it.
You were gloating so much.
I honestly couldn't keep, I was like, oh, lads, that's not looking good for you now. And I had to sit back for them. So I can jump either way, and it's like,
But what about the views of the man or woman on the street? On Thursday's News at One, reporter Cian Burns brought us this vox pop.
Oh, God, no. Oh, no. Come on, Spain. Spain have been a better team the whole tournament, in my opinion. England, in my opinion, have been quite lucky. So I think Spain for the win, 100%.
Of course I would. But they, I won't say they've been lucky, but they've relied on moments of... they haven't really impressed me, but they've relied on great moments. But of course I would. I don't have a major... I mean, like some of the players, Harry Kane and... but I think Spain are everyone's favourites, aren't they?
It don't really matter who wins, to be honest, as long as it's a good game. But look, they're our neighbours at the end of the day, aren't they? So, you know.
No. They don't like us, we don't like those.
No, unfortunately not, no.
Yes, why not? They're our neighbours. We, a lot of Irish people like myself, support British teams and follow the players. So, yeah, why not? Best of luck to them. Obviously, they're not our favourite team, but, I mean... this comes some excellent players, and it's more about the football for me.
No, I don't think I'd be able to do that to myself now, but I think I'll be back in Spain all the way. So.
And do you support a Premier League team?
Yeah, Man United.
And what's the difference between supporting Man United and England?
It's a good question, actually. I think there's just a little bit of separation there, but I think it's you're back in a club and they're all from different nations, and I think with a national team like that, I don't think you could do it.
Not just United and England. Compare and contrast, that's a whole other discussion. Cian Burns, our reporter, speaking to people earlier.
The other big soccer-related story that broke this week was the surprise appointment of the former Icelandic manager Heimir Hallgrímsson as the new manager of the Republic of Ireland. One man who got to know the new manager when he was working as a coach in Iceland is Christopher Harrington, brother of the boxer Kelly Harrington. He spoke to Cormac on Drive Time.
Came across him quite a few times. Actually stayed in his house a couple of times Jaime is from a place in Iceland, just off the coast, actually, the Westman Islands, where Ibiza Vest, the club, is located. So they have one of the biggest youth tournaments every year on that island. So, of course, you have a lot of people traveling to a small place, and the ability to rent the place is small. So I know him well. I know his son very well, and
and it's an exciting time, and especially since you know him so well, you've got the inside track. What kind of a manager is he?
I think he's the type of person, first and foremost, that we as a nation have been screaming out to lead the national team. Somebody that can relate to the public. You know, he's an ordinary, hard-working man. The story of him being a dentist is well documented. But I think he's somebody that the public can relate to. And he's somebody that can get players and fans on side very quickly, has the ability to lead. Obviously, he'll have a plan in terms of how he wants the team to play based on players and personnel that are available. So, I'm very optimistic about what he's going to bring to us.
Icelandic journalist Bogi Alfgeirsson also had lots of good things to say about the new manager in an interview with Claire Byrne. When Claire asked him about his coaching style, he explained that Hallgrímsson favours a defensive style of play.
It was defence mainly, and I would guess that he would follow a similar strategy when he is coaching Ireland. The similarity between Iceland and Ireland is that all the best footballers, they play abroad.
Yes.
Because that has some challenges, of course, because the players come from very different teams, very different football cultures. So he has to melt that into a team which has team spirit, which is proud to play for the country.
And, you know, he will obviously have to keep a very close eye on footballers who are coming up through the ranks as well because of that problem, because a lot of the very good ones tend to, as you said there, leave our shores and go and play, particularly with Premiership clubs. So he'll have to watch for new talent as well. So given that he left the Iceland job voluntarily, he went off to the Middle East and then on to Jamaica, how do you think he's viewed? Is he well respected in the football world?
As far as I know, he is, because I mean, he has gotten results with a tiny country. I mean, the population of Iceland is roughly about the same as the city of Cork, and getting Iceland to two finals is no mean feat.
Right.
I mean, it's Iceland definitely punched above the weight.
From Wednesday's Today with Claire Byrne. That's the late, great Rory Gallagher playing on his famous Fender Stratocaster guitar, which was in the news this week because his brother and former manager Donal decided to put it up for auction. Legend has it that the guitar was first owned by Jim Conlon of the Royal Show Band, who bought it in New York, but because he didn't like the colour, sold it on to Crowley's Music Shop in Cork. Donal told Gavin Jennings on the News at One how his then 15-year-old brother Rory first set his sights on the guitar when he spotted it in Crowley's window.
Rory, who was probably just 15, going on 16 at the time, had joined a show band. So he'd sort of cheated on his age and said he was 17 going on 18. But when they auditioned him, they brought him into the lineup, but he'd required a better guitar, electric guitar, than the one he had. And Rory had spotted this, and being a huge Buddy Holly fan, it was the guitar, it was that what Rory wanted. And my mother had signed a hire purchase agreement for the 12-pound guitar. So Rory went and negotiated with Mr. Crowley, Michael Crowley, to see if he could extend the payments to encompass the sum of £100. And the show band he was with, it was then called the Fontana, later the Impact, had a run of dates. So Rory was able to show him a date sheet and the possibility that he had the funds to pay for it. Michael kind of agreed, and so the guitar was taken home, hidden under my bed, so my mother didn't see. And then she happened to bump into Michael Crawley, said, how's your son getting on with the guitar? So that was the first time she was aware of it. And I mean, the poor woman just, she couldn't cope with that amount of money. But anyway, Rory promised her faithfully that he would, and the fact that actually with that guitar he could improve his playing immensely. And not only that, the show band who had a rhythm guitarist, they might need the rhythm guitarist because he could do both jobs and get double pay. So there was all sorts of yarn spun at the time to convince my mother, who then did go down and officially sign the forms.
Fans will know how synonymous this guitar was to Rory. Can you explain to us how important this guitar was to him?
It was the closest thing to having a limb. The instrument was how Rory expressed himself. And then it's early on, when he formed Taste, I think after one of the first gigs in Dublin that they did, the guitar was stolen. And that was like losing somebody. It was like a bereavement for a week until Garda Patrol put it up on the television at the time. And the guitar did return to him. So it's kind of never left his side since that point.
God bless Garda Patrol. Immediately after that item was aired on the News at One, some callers to Liveline had strong views about the potential fate of the Fender Stratocaster.
He was our Jimi Hendrix in a way. Yeah, I mean, he's a secular saint. These are secular relics, particularly the Stratocaster. That's infused with his DNA.
I think
his blood, his sweat, his tears. You know?
I have a big interest in artifacts and all of that. And I think this guitar, in years to come, would be looked in a similar vein to the Arda chalice or the Book of Kells,
yes,
or something like that.
Exactly.
It's such an iconic artifact as far as modern Irish history and culture is concerned.
Yeah. It's a national treasure.
It is. It is. What would be fantastic is if we'd say Cork City Council could come together with Donegal County Council and buy this guitar and then pass it between the museums and the respective areas.
Well, it's,
and give everyone a turn to see it. It'd be fantastic.
John, another caller to Liveline, once worked as a lighting technician with Rory Gallagher. He told Katie about one gig he remembered, which he drove Rory to.
Everyone on the crew had one and a half jobs or two jobs. And one of mine was driving. If they were short on people, I would drive Donal and Rory and maybe one of the band. And in this instance, the band were ahead of us and Donal had some business to do in the next city. So I was driving Rory, just me and Rory in the car. And Rory hated leaving too early for gigs. So invariably you'd be sitting around in the afternoon wondering, you know, are we going to get enough time to get to the next gig? And eventually we got going and we were going to be late. And I'll never forget pulling into the gig with Rory. And he always traveled with the Strat. The Strat was always in the boot. He never had it on the truck or anything. He always traveled with that Strat and the practice amp. Because he'd practice in the nighttime, you know, in the hotel. But when we pulled into the gig, the promoter was hanging out the backstage door,
sweating,
red faced, and so nervous he thought he was going to have to cancel the gig. But all you could hear was the whole place shouting, "Rory, Rory, Rory!" And he walked into the gig. I was behind him. I carried the Strat for him. Went in, took off his coat, took off his jacket, check shirt and the jeans, put on the Strat, walked out on stage and just said into the mic, "Let's go to work." And then 1, 2, 3, 4 and just mayhem. He was just a mesmerizing performer.
The theme of show bands, which were mentioned in relation to Rory's early career, was also up for discussion on Tuesday when Paul Mescal Sr., who's performing in a new musical about the show band era called Are You Dancin', came in to talk to Maura Doran. In the week that the trailer for the new Gladiator movie was released, Maura wondered if Paul claims credit for his son's acting talent.
He didn't lick it off the stones. Did he get it all from you, all the starriness?
It just so happened. He just morphed into that area and he found his own way and he carved out his own furrow on that. So anything, and maybe I might have been influential, I'll take any credits that are being given out to me.
Well, you certainly will. But of course, your father passed it to you.
Oh, yes. Well, my father actually put me on the stage back in 1978. No, I actually plagued him to put me on the stage. So he had been an actor himself. He was a farmer from West Clare, but he was also interested in drama and that. that. Every rural area has a drama club and a GA club, and that was the thing he was into, and he gave it to me, and then I certainly would have passed some of it on to Paul. He would have taken the flavour of it, so I suppose maybe a little bit I could take.
Oh, I think you could take a lot more than that. Didn't you win the Best Actor Award?
How did you hear about that?
Oh, everybody. You know what? You've eclipsed your son just by being here in front of me right now.
Yeah, I did, but that was it. That was about the height of it for me, you know. So that journey, you know, I was really proud of that, and it did go back to my father, and I was so, you know, so grateful for that. And that's I suppose how I got myself here into this fantastic.
What was the show? Just remind me of the show won the award. Because your dad won the award too.
It was a play called The Salvage Shop by Jim Nolan, a great Irish writer. Really,
and your dad, of course, won the award as well. So now
he won it back in 57.
So all the way from the 50s to today. An Oscar winner, I predict now, with your son.
Well, that's great. Oh, but me? Oh no!
You've won your awards, Paul.
I think we leave it to the younger generation. Yes.
From the Oliver Callan Show, presented by Maura Duran on Tuesday. Roscommon woman Tori Towey hit the headlines this week when her plight was raised in the Dáil by Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald, who reported that the 28-year-old air hostess who had been attacked in her home in Dubai, where she had been living for the past year, was facing charges of attempted suicide and alcohol consumption. Other politicians, including the Taoiseach, quickly got involved, as did the Department of Foreign Affairs. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Tori's aunt, Anne Flynn, told Adele McAllister that her sister Christine had flown out to Dubai to be with her daughter.
Well, they're very nervous and they just can't wait to get home. Being in a strange country on their own, it's very hard. Tori can't travel, so Caroline has to stay with Tori. So, you know, we're just all very, very anxious.
What are you hoping might happen now?
Well, we keep hoping that we'll get word that they're on a plane on their way home. I don't know, will this court case go ahead, or if it does, what will happen? It's really terrible that this has happened to a young woman, you know, that was full of life and full of adventure, and she loved travelling, and, you know, she's a beautiful young woman.
And Anne, have you been able to speak to your sister, Tori's mother, Caroline, and to Tori herself? How have they been doing?
Oh, yes. I've been in touch with them every day, several times a day, since all this started. They're both trying to keep positive. We're trying to keep positive as well. But hopefully with Rada Sterling and the Taoiseach and all the ministers that's helping now, hopefully we'll hear good news.
You'll have heard Anne mention Rada Sterling there. She's a human rights activist who runs an organisation called Detained in Dubai. She also spoke to Mary Wilson on Wednesday's Morning Ireland about her involvement in Tori's case.
Does she have legal representation?
No, she doesn't. It's extremely prohibitively expensive in the UAE, and foreigners are almost seen as targets by lawyers, so you could expect fees of around maybe $50,000 for a case like this.
Can I just come back to the charges with you again, Arada, please? What are the likely outcomes for somebody charged and convicted with the offences you outlined to us of alcohol abuse and attempted suicide?
There's no such thing as precedent in the UAE, so it absolutely comes down to the judge, and it could be, you know, 3 months in prison, it could be 2 years in prison, or it could be a fine and deportation, or it could actually be putting her in some sort of mental institution. So they've got all of those remedies available to them. Or, you know, in a best case scenario, they will simply say, OK, we're not going to proceed beyond this hearing and we're going to let you go.
And what does she want Taoiseach Simon Harris, the Irish Prime Minister, to do now?
Well, the best thing to do is speak to their counterparts in the UAE and just simply say, we can't have this. This is obviously an error on behalf of the Dubai police. This never should have been charged or prosecuted. And they need to be trained on victim care, I think, more than anything. And hopefully the government of Dubai will see, you know, that these charges are without merit, that they shouldn't happen, and they need to protect women. And it's, you know, a terrible PR for the country. You know, you're going to have people worried to go there in the future. And of course, this is on the back of, you know, historically charging rape victims with sex outside marriage. So they don't have the best reputation to start with. They've been trying to improve it. So I think they'll be agreeable with the Irish government if there's enough diplomatic pressure put on them, letting them know that we absolutely want Tori home, and there's just going to be no negotiation on that.
By lunchtime on Wednesday, we heard the good news that Tori and her mum Christine were already on a flight on their way home to Ireland. On drive time, Cormac O'Hara spoke to Tori about how it felt to be home.
Who was at the airport to welcome you home?
So I had my two aunties, Anne and Trish, and then my uncle Cyril.
And I'd say the hugs were like you've never experienced before.
Yeah, no, it's nice to have family there. It was very emotional. I'm just looking forward to just getting home this evening and just resting and just spending time with people.
Can I just say to you how much of an outpouring of the love there was for you and concern as well on our programme alone and replicated across all programmes and all stations?
I know. I still can't believe it. I'm in shock, but it makes me so emotional, but I'm so grateful to everybody. You know, like Radha Sterling, who we contacted, I think it was the day before yesterday, and she just, the minute we contacted her, she got everything going. Mary Lou, Bring to the Doll, Claire Caron, Taoiseach, Simon Harris, Tánaiste, Micheál Martin, and the ambassadors, the embassy, like they've been amazing in Dubai. Like they took care of everything for me. They really were. I know they were working basically through the night, you know, just to try and get me home and do everything they could. So I'm so grateful because obviously there's other people that aren't as lucky as me. Mm-hmm. To come from a country like this and have so much support behind me, and then like my family and my friends, you know, they've kind of kept me going and they've been there for me and through all of this, and it obviously hasn't been easy for them at the same time because, you know, my poor mother was so far away when all of this was happening, and
she went to you in Dubai, did she, as well, your mother?
Yeah, she flew over to Dubai. Sometimes you just need, you're not thinking straight when you're kind of in that situation. You need someone to kind of take the reins on things. And you need that kind of strong support system.
Roscommon woman Tori Towey has heard on Drive Time on Thursday. Andrew Pearce is a well-known British television presenter and newspaper columnist. He was a guest of Claire Burns on Thursday. On this occasion, however, he wasn't talking about politics, but about his book Finding Margaret, which he's just had published, about his own experience of finding and meeting up with his Irish-born birth mother, who placed him in an orphanage in Bristol shortly after he was born.
The sad thing was when we did get together and we met up that first time, she didn't ask me a single question about my life, my upbringing, which was surprising, but I guess yeah. She had her reasons.
That really puzzled me, your description of that first meeting in British Home Stores, as you said, yeah. having a cup of tea. She told you a lot about her life, and she had gone on and been married and had her own family and so on, but nothing, she didn't ask you anything about you.
Not a question. She married a man called Patrick, which I was quite struck by because I was Patrick, and she had four children. The third son she called Patrick. And I looked her in the eye and said, did you think of me when you called him Patrick? Nothing. No, she didn't register. I asked her about the orphanage. I don't remember. I asked about who my birth father was. I don't remember. She'd either managed to bury me like nuclear waste, or she just couldn't open up the file because it was too painful. But I said to her again at the end, would you like to meet again? She said, I'd love to see you again. She kissed me on the lips and said, you've made my life because I'm so happy that you're happy. And part of the reason I'd found her was to let her know that I was okay. But we then arranged to meet in the same British Home Stores three times. And I was driving, coming down from London each time, and she didn't show up.
Right.
It was very hard because I would call her half an hour before I was there, say, are you ready, Margaret? Are you on your way? I'm putting my best scarf on. And something spooked her, and there was always an excuse why she didn't show up. But she didn't call me to say she wasn't coming. I didn't call the next day to say, sorry, I didn't get there. So I would then call and say, do you not want to meet me anymore, Margaret? I understand. Just let me know. I do understand. I do want to see you. You've got many questions to ask me, and I can answer them for you. But she never did.
And how have you managed to
deal with all of this? Because that part where you, you know, you have those arranged meetings with her and she doesn't show up and she doesn't want to tell you anything about the circumstances of your birth and your adoption, they're incredibly hard things to cope with.
They were, actually, and I didn't realise how difficult, but what I realised was a very good Catholic priest friend said, we've got to get you to see someone because we've got to find Patrick and talk to Patrick. I said, Patrick, what do you mean? He said, Patrick's still here. Patrick's still there. He said, when Patrick moved to your mum and dad in Swindon, he didn't go away. He just retreated inside. He'd been rejected by his mother. That's how he would have felt because she just stopped visiting me in the home. He said, but then she's rejected you again. And so I actually had therapy and I realised that all the rejections that little Patrick endured as a little boy manifested itself when she didn't see me at British Home Stores those three or even four times. Mm-hmm. So I never thought this hard-nosed political journalist who's used to having fights with prime ministers and foreign secretaries would be sitting in a therapist's chair, but indeed I did, and it was incredibly good for me and constructive, and a lot of stuff came out that I didn't know had been locked away for 50 years.
Andrew Pearce talking to Claire Byrne about his new book, Finding Margaret. Cork South Central TD and former Minister Simon Coveney announced this week that he won't be running in the next general election. When he spoke to Carol Coleman on the News at One, he was keen to talk about Britain's newly elected Prime Minister.
I think Keir Starmer as British Prime Minister will be really good for the British-Irish relationship. I know Keir Starmer very well because he was the Brexit negotiator for the Labour Party for a while. While I was in that position for the Irish government. He cares about Ireland. He also understands the Irish mindset, which isn't always the case in Westminster. He spent 5 years in Northern Ireland as a human rights advisor to the PSNI. So we do have a prime minister now who really understands why the partnership between Britain and Ireland at a government level is so important to a successful and stable peace process in the north. And I think that can be to our benefit. And I suspect both Micheál Martin and Simon Harris will be working closely with their counterparts in the British government to make sure that we take advantage of this new opportunity now.
Before I let you go, what are your own plans?
Good question. I mean, for the first time since I was 25, I'm actually now looking at what life might be like outside of politics and how I can make myself useful. I mean, I'm as energetic, as positive, as focused and as motivated now as I've always been in terms of the work that I do. So I'm not leaving politics because I'm tired. Absolutely not. So I hope to be working hard in whatever I do. But I have, you know, some options that are unfolding, but I'm not going to rush into that.
Ray Darcy interviewed another high-profile politician this week. From his home in Dublin's North Inner City, David Norris chatted about his life and times. In this excerpt, Ray asked him about the first ever Dublin Pride, which took place 50 years ago this year.
How many people were at the first Pride event?
Seven.
And I think it peaked at 75,000.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we walked in single file. You know, and
was that to make you look as if there were more of you?
Oh, yes, exactly. And we picketed the Department of Justice and the British Embassy.
And your placard read,
"Homosexuals are revolting," which was a double entendre.
What a brilliant play on words.
It was fun.
You must have been very proud of yourself with that
one. The 46A bus nearly went through the wall when the driver caught sight of us. And all the ministers, secretaries were up in the Department of Foreign Affairs looking out the window. And a lorry drove up with the minister's carpet on it.
Right.
And it was heaved out onto the footpath. And the helper said, "Jesus me, fucking queers." And he said, "I don't give a damn. A picket's a picket, mate." And he took up a picket and walked around with us for half an hour. Yeah, it was rather fun.
Yeah, he wasn't going to pass a picket.
And as well as being the anniversary of Pride, Ray reminded David that this summer also marks another significant birthday.
There's a big birthday coming up at the end of this month.
Yes, I shall be 80 at the end of July. Yes.
Right.
And I'm having a little party.
Invitation
just for
only.
Close friends.
Yes.
Oh, invitation only, yes.
How do you feel about hitting 80?
Well, I think it's just a number, you know. But the only thing is, some days I feel 16. But other days I realise I'm slowing down.
Yeah.
Which is inevitable.
Mm. And is there somebody, a significant other in your life?
There is, yes.
Right. And will they be at the party?
They most certainly will, flying over from London.
Great, great.
Yes.
And speaking of age, the always inspiring Professor Roseanne Kenny, Head of Ageing at Trinity College Dublin, came in for a chat with Maura Duran on Wednesday.
Genetics matter. Genetics contribute to about 30% of how we age and everything. But the good news there is that 70% of how we age is within our own control.
70%?
70% is not genetics. So everything we're talking about now, having a positive attitude, having physical activity, engaging with other people, the use of language, etc., that's part of what we call the exposome, the environmental things that influence how we as animals age biologically. The number of candles on our birthday cake says nothing about what's happening in the background biologically. That's the first thing.
So we should drop our chronological age.
Drop it.
If you're familiar with the work that Philip Boucher Hayes does, you'll know he's never one to shy away from the big questions facing humanity. His new series, Hot Mess, which is also available to podcast, is no different. In an episode broadcast on Radio 1 this week, Philip provided some fascinating insights into the world of geoengineering and climate repair.
So working backwards, we're looking for those droplets. Just before that, there is a pipe that feeds this nozzle, which is a converging, diverging nozzle.
Geoengineering is a lot less Wild West and a lot more grown up now. I'm in the Centre for Climate Repair in Cambridge University with Professor Sean Fitzgerald.
And it takes in water, builds it up in pressure, and puts it through the system.
Which is a long way, then, is it, of saying you are boiling seawater to make a mist?
Well, strictly speaking, we hope that we're not boiling seawater.
You'll notice the rebranding. Geoengineering has become climate repair.
And later in the programme, Professor Fitzgerald outlined the three climate repair options he favours most.
I like to call it the radiation game. What can we do that might reduce the rate at which the sun's radiation is impacting on the Earth? And the most far out one in terms of distance is indeed the idea about sending out into space a series of mirrors to try and reflect some of the sun's radiation away from the Earth before it gets to the Earth. That's option number one. The next option would be looking at something called stratospheric aerosol injection. And this is a technique that is based on looking at what happens in nature when a large volcano erupts. A good one to refer to is Mount Pinatubo in 1991. It ended up putting 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide up into the stratosphere. Earth was cooled by something like half a degree centigrade for 1 to 2 years. And then method three, something called marine cloud brightening. The game there is, can we create more sea spray to create more smaller droplets rather than larger ones? And when clouds are comprised of more smaller droplets, then there is a greater surface area from which the sun's radiation can be reflected. They are also optically brighter. They're whiter clouds rather than darker clouds.
And if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you can find more from Philip on his Radio 1 podcast series, Hot Mess. Another series which caught my attention this week was Irish Imperial Lives, presented by A.B. Philbin Bowman and Kate O'Malley. In this week's programme, they spoke to Australian-based journalist and academic Siobhan McHugh about a post-famine scheme which saw the deportation of 4,000 Irish women and girls from workhouses here to Australia. For many of them, however, it wasn't easy to shake off the shackles of poverty.
When the women came to Australia as young girls, they arrived out in such poor condition because of famine that their pelvis was often malformed or not properly developed.
Oh, wow, from malnutrition.
From malnutrition. Mm-hmm. And then there was a study done at the Royal Women's Hospital Melbourne in 1860 that showed that 1 in 15 Irish women had an underdeveloped pelvis. But then the problem, the ghastly problem, is that in the more, prolific food environment in Australia, they become healthy enough to get pregnant, but they're not developed enough to be able to have the baby pass through the birth canal because it's so stunted.
That's horrendous.
And so it was absolutely heartbreaking. There was one woman who lost six babies through this procedure called craniotomy. It's like a horrible throwback from, they think they've escaped the famine, but it comes back to haunt them.
Yeah.
From Irish Imperial Lives, presented by Aby Fubin-Bowman and Kate O'Malley. Katie Hannon was standing in for Joe Duffy all this week on Liveline, and on Wednesday, when she was doing her promo for the show on The Louise Duffy Show, she floated an item which immediately struck a chord with Louise.
A listener was in touch about the value of giving children elocution lessons.
Mm.
Yes. I'm wondering, does this still happen?
They call it speech and drama. We were elocution, and then younger siblings were speech and drama.
Oh, I could tell from your vowel sounds, Louise, that you'd...
I spent my Wednesday afternoons well. Yes. Mrs. Marr. Mm.
Joyce has joined the ballet class and poises on her points.
And on foot of that promo, Mary rang in to recall the elocution lessons she did as a student of Sister Emmanuel in St. Mary's All-Girls School in Cove.
I can remember one of the rhymes. It was like, we used to do it at the start of the class, and it was my needle's too thin for my thread to pass through. So this is what I'll do. I'll ask my mother to buy me another, and with it, a thimble too.
So that was sorting out your THs, obviously.
That was sorting out THs, which there was huge emphasis on the THs, So, and I suppose it all was probably stood to me.
Fergal also rang in with his memories of what he learned from his much-loved Auntie Anne, who did some work on the Reardons and Fair City.
Taught us Dapple Grey, that one, and it's still fully, I remember every word.
Give us a blast of Dapple Grey.
I had a little pony, his name was Dapple Grey. I lent him to a lady to ride a mile away. Well, she whipped him and she lashed him and she rode him through the mire. Now, I would not lend my pony now for all that lady's hire. What do you think?
That's a round of applause, Fergal. It's incredible how these stick. It sticks in your head, these poems, isn't it? I mean, that's not today or yesterday you learned that.
She was so. We used to love, because she was famous. She was in TV and stuff, and with RTE doing work, and we all thought she was famous. She was so elegant, and she used to come out in her little sports car. And we were living on a farm, so it was so nice. Always all her visits. She's my godmother, and I miss her dearly.
Fergal, as heard on Liveline on Wednesday. And in a completely unrelated conversation a little later in the afternoon, Ray spoke to New York-based Irish comedian Katie Boyle about her new show and his elocution lessons.
Katie is an Irish comedian living in New York City and has brought her new show, Therapy. There's no H in that.
There's no H in it, no.
Because that's the way to say it in Kildare.
That's how we say it in Leasup, yeah.
Oh, I see you're going to Therapy.
Yeah. How would you pronounce it? Would you pronounce your TH?
Well,
I thought that was a universal Irish thing.
No, you see.
You went to fancy school?
No, I'm on the radio.
Here's
the secret, Katie. I was a year in this organisation and I was sent off to elocution lessons. I used to say therapy instead of therapy.
Yeah.
And I used to say one instead of one.
Okay.
Yeah, so this guy grabbed me and he said, listen, yeah, you're doing well, but I think you should go off and get some elocution lessons.
I did have to change how I pronounce my name in the States because I would have said Katie, but then people were calling me Haiti, like the country. So I had to then be like Katie, which is a lot more boring. Yeah.
Yeah.
When they finished talking about elocution, Katie told Ray about how she first got into comedy when, after graduating from art college, she was working as a very badly paid intern in an art gallery in New York.
There was a comedy club across the street and, you know, with art you need to buy all these materials and stuff like this, and I didn't have the money and I was barely surviving there. I was actually putting on weight because I was stealing bagels from the art place. So I was eating 8 bagels a day for food. It was mental. And then when I started comedy, it was just so much easier and you didn't need you just use your voice.
Yeah.
And everybody was so nice and they were from all walks of life. And yeah, so I loved it. And I only started it because the comedy club was across the street and they had a show where they let audience members tell a joke. And so I went up and did that. And the host was like, you should do this. And I was like, okay, grand. And then I just started.
Is that really how it happened?
I swear my life. Like, I'd gone a few times and watched that show. And then I kind of thought about it. And then a few of my friends who I was going with were from South America. And like, I'd find here, like, Irish people are so funny. You never really get a chance to even finish a story. We're kind of all talking over each other and you're kind of coming in with a funny line. But there, they just gave me this space to like tell stories about home. And they were like, oh, you should be a comedian. And I was like, what? No, this is just being Irish. And then we went to the show and I went up and that was it. The host was like, only open mic comedians actually get up. No regular audience members ever actually get up. So you should try this. And I did the next day.
But I'm fascinated by this. So you hadn't practiced in front of a mirror or anything like that? It was
no, just telling stories to my friends. Yeah.
Comedian Katie Boyle talking to Ray on Wednesday. The final piece I picked for you this morning is taken from last week's Sunday Miscellany. It's called All You Need Is Love and it's written by Kathy Power about her experience of getting kitted out to be mother of the bride to her only daughter.
A radical makeover took place. I got new caps on my front teeth. I spent more money than I can admit on reshaping and dyeing my hair. I got new glasses. I had my eyebrows tinted and threaded. The pain involved surprised me greatly. I did not go on a diet. I have been struggling with my weight for over 50 years now, and I have surrendered. Neither did I resort to shapewear. After an experimental outing in one such garment ended in a very embarrassing episode in the ladies' room of a renowned department store. I had to lock myself in a cubicle, take off all my clothes, and get help to extricate myself in order to breathe again before I fainted. I imagined myself in less wholesome circumstances with a couple of gin and tonics on board and decided that wearing my own shape was preferable. My daughter, meanwhile, with little fuss, had found the perfect wedding dress, all the appropriate accessories, dressed her bridesmaids, advised on the groomsmen, and organised the whole day. But I was still looking. We got there in the end. I found a dress. A hat, shoes and a bag were purchased and deemed appropriate by the steering committee and I was all set. While the wedding wasn't in a church, the walking down the aisle tradition was to be observed. Our little family is made up of my son, my daughter and I. So we agreed that her brother and I would enter the ceremony room on each side of the bride and walk her to her groom. There was no prouder woman in the world at that moment, when the three of us stepped into view and the celebrant prompted a round of applause. Everyone stood up and turned around to get a good look at us. The bride was stunning in ivory. My son was rocking it in a beautiful suit. And I was after spending 2 years and a lot of money to look as good as humanly possible for this exact moment. I looked around the room and saw the women there who had helped me raise 2 children. Sometimes in chaotic and heartbreaking circumstances, to become the 2 fine young adults walking beside me. As the applause became more raucous and turned to cheering and tears, I knew that I could have been walking down that room in a sack, because all that mattered that day was love.
Kathy Power, as heard on last week's Sunday Miscellany. That's about my lot for this week. I hope you enjoyed the programme. Sinead's back in this chair next week. So until next time, goodbye.